How fast do you drive down valley streets? Don't worry, no photo radar here, but advocates want you to slow down. Slow down and see the businesses.
Our brand is suburbs and traffic, and that brand is no longer in demand.
I'm Mark Brody. Ahead on the show, how Phoenix's streets could become more complete. Also, what the results of this week's Phoenix City Council elections could mean for the priorities of the city. Nonprofits are heading into donation season. Will they have enough resources to meet their clients' needs? And utility regulators are expected to decide the fate of net metering next week. So what is the future of solar energy in Arizona?
Through technological advances, we have been given something that can take our economy to the next level. It will make the dot-com boom look like nothing.
Plus, a quiet break in the middle of the city. That and more coming up on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama is cheering an unexpected surge in jobs, but NPR's Scott Horsley says today's monthly labor report also shows a slight increase in the unemployment rate, likely a result of the 16-day government shutdown in October.
U.S. employers added more than 200,000 jobs in October, far more than analysts had predicted. President Obama says that's another sign of the resilience of the U.S. economy, but he complained political infighting continues to pour cold water on the recovery. Unemployment ticked up last month to 7.3% as hundreds of thousands of federal workers were furloughed during the government shutdown. Consumer confidence also tumbled, which could hurt growth going forward.
And it's like the gears of our economy, every time they are just about to take off, suddenly somebody taps the brakes and says, not so fast.
The president was speaking at the Port of New Orleans, where he argued the government could boost jobs by investing more in transportation facilities. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
The Obama administration has announced a rule requiring insurers to cover mental health and substance abuse services exactly as they would physical illnesses. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius unveiled details today while speaking at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Secretary of State John Kerry says still a lot of gaps between six world powers and Iran on its nuclear program. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports Kerry and three EU foreign ministers arrived in Geneva today.
Kerry's sudden decision to come to Geneva sparked hopes that a first-step agreement with Iran was imminent. But as he landed, Kerry spoke not of a deal, but of differences.
I want to emphasize there is not an agreement at this point in time. We hope to try to narrow those differences, but I don't think anybody should mistake that there are some important gaps that have to be closed.
The foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany also rushed to Geneva, adding diplomatic heft to the talks aimed at restricting Iran's nuclear program in exchange for limited relief from economic sanctions. Israel's prime minister calls it the deal of the century for Iran and a bad deal for the international community. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Geneva.
Central Philippines still assessing the impact of one of the strongest storms on record. Typhoon Haiyan raced across several islands, took out communication systems in several provinces, also triggered landslides. However, local authorities say the storm blew away before it was able to cause more damage, but the storm's full extent has yet to be known. Authorities say they've confirmed at least four deaths. At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 168 points or more than 1% at 15,762. All the major U.S. indexes up more than 1%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Couple problem spots to tell you about on the Valley Freeway, specifically the I-10. Westbound, the on-ramp is blocked at 107th Avenue, and just a bit further west, the exit ramp is also blocked at Avondale Boulevard. Look for a sunny weekend, including all the way through Veterans Day on Monday, with highs in the mid-80s. Right now, mostly sunny skies, 82 degrees. In the news this hour, state auditors report officials with the Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind spent nearly $10,000 in excessive or inappropriate travel expenses during a 33-month period that ended earlier this year. The Auditor General's office says many of the expenses by Superintendent Robert Hill lack documentation required under state policies. According to the office's report, inappropriate expenses included extra nights on trips and renting a car and paying hundreds of dollars for parking on a trip when a hotel shuttle was available. The auditors are recommending that school officials improve their procedures. The school's acting superintendent says it's scheduling training for its employees. The Arizona Supreme Court is looking for input on a campaign finance case. The justices want to hear from lawyers for the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission before deciding whether to consider an appeal of a ruling that put higher limits on campaign contributions on hold. The appeals court had ruled the new law's higher campaign contribution limits could not be implemented because they conflict with the voter-approved law creating the commission. Officials with the Arizona State Fair say the 18-day event set an attendance record this year for the five-day-a-week schedule. Nearly 1.2 million people visited the fair, an increase of more than 24,000 people from last year. Officials credit mild weather and more attractions and concerts for the increased attendance. If you want to get a look at one of the world's biggest solar power plants, all you got to do is drive a little bit south and west of the valley near Gila Bend. That's where you'll find the Solana plant. That's what my colleague Steve Shadley did earlier this week. He joins me now. Steve, what does this thing look like?
You can't miss it. It's just west of Gila Bend, and it's right next to the freeway. This solar plant called Solana is 3 square miles of solar panels, and there's a big sort of power plant in the middle with steam rising into the sky, and there are wires and pipes going every direction. It's producing power for about 70,000 APS customers around Arizona.
So how is this plant different than other solar facilities people might have seen driving around the valley?
Well, the main difference is sort of a new technological breakthrough, because the problem with solar energy right now is there's not a lot of capacity to store the energy, but they now have this technology where they actually mix salt with water. And it's a special kind of salt, I'm told, Mark. It comes from Chile, and it has an ability, when you mix it with water and spin it at a certain speed, that it can actually store electricity that's produced at this solar
power. Kind of like a battery.
Exactly. The storage reach is only 6 hours after the electricity is actually produced, whereas with your old traditional photovoltaic solar panels that we're used to, the black ones that you see, the energy is immediately used or sent back to the grid. But now they have the capacity to store this energy for about 6 hours. I had a chance to talk to Brad Albert. He's a resource manager with APS, and he says Solana in Arizona is the first solar plant that uses this mixture of salt and water to store electricity for peak demand periods, like around 5 o'clock when a lot of people get home from work and they turn on their air conditioners on a hot day.
What that allows us to do is keep producing electricity well after sunset. In fact, on a hot summer day, this plant will be able to keep producing electricity all the way till midnight or so.
So, Steve Shadley, what kind of impact might Solana have on APS customers' utility bills?
Well, this is an interesting question. APS had a media tour of the plant this week, and that question, of course, came up. And they said basically that it's not going to touch the rates that customers are paying right now immediately. But in the long run, over the next 30 years or so, the great thing about this plant, they're telling us, is that the prices will always be constant because, of course, sunlight is free, and they don't have to worry about fluctuations in the global market for current supplies of energy. And here's what Brad Albert had to say about that.
APS has to go out on the open market and buy natural gas at prevailing market prices to fuel those power plants. And that can sometimes be a volatile or unstable type of price that we pay for our natural gas.
KJZZ, Steve Shadley. Steve, thanks.
You bet. Thank you, Mark.
Solana has been up and running for about a month now, and there's been a lot of discussion recently about net metering. The Arizona Corporation Commission is scheduled to hear about that issue starting on Wednesday and could vote on it next week as well. The politics of solar energy have been on full display, so we wanted to get a sense of what those politics are. We have two perspectives, starting with former Arizona Congressman Republican Ben Quayle.
We need to be able to diversify our economy away from kind of rooftops and growth for growth's sakes. And I think solar could be one of those things. At the federal level, and I think at the state level as well, we got to make sure that we're not providing disincentives for research and development and being able to make sure that solar is a going entity, I mean, a going concern going forward. Right now, I think that it's getting a little bit too propped up by various incentives that I believe are actually making it more difficult for the industry to actually get to that place where it's going to be a direct competition to other types of energy, whether it's fossil fuel or carbon-based energy.
In Washington, D.C., in Congress, how big of an issue is solar energy? I mean, obviously it's a big deal here because it's sunny all the time, but in a place like D.C. with the federal government, is it as big a priority?
Well, I think energy is a priority, you know, when you look at it from a macro level. We are seeing a boom in oil and natural gas, and we can continue to see a boom in solar and alternative forms of energy. And we need to make sure that we are providing that and allowing that to happen, allowing that development to happen. Because we have been, through technological advances, we have been given something that can take our economy to the next level. It will make the dot-com boom look like nothing if we actually allow this to happen.
So you don't think that government funding of solar and other alternative energy in and of itself is necessarily a bad thing? It sounds like you want it to be more based on abilities or on merit than trying to say, okay, we want to do solar, but maybe not biomass, for example.
A, you want it to be technologically neutral. And the other part is, I think basic research from funding by the government is a good thing. I don't think once you get past that point, where then it just becomes basically corporate cronyism and you're starting to see pick winners and losers and you're starting to see, hey, wow, that person donated to this campaign and, oh, shocking, he gets a big pile of money from the government. That's where the problems lie. But basic research, that's something that the government should be helping in.
Do you think that the state's policies on solar energy and the amount of solar energy that we produce and use here in the state is commensurate with the amount of support that Arizonans say that they give to solar energy?
Well, in context of this ACC battle, which has been an entertaining thing to watch, it seems like
the net metering debate.
Yes, the net metering debate. I think when you ask in a polling question if people support solar, of course you do. I mean, everybody supports solar. But when you start to get down to the nitty-gritty of things and how much it costs, what sort of subsidies are actually going into it, I think then you're going to start to see a little bit of a change in that poll answer.
That was Republican Ben Quayle, a former Arizona congressman. Now, this may shock you a little bit, but David Shapira doesn't completely disagree with what Quayle had to say. A Democrat, Shapira is the former minority leader of the Arizona Senate.
If you look at a comparison of Arizona to other states, which, you know, many states are, you know, kind of, especially in the Southwest, are at the forefront of solar, we rank up there. I mean, we actually have some pretty good solar policies in Arizona.
What do you think Arizonans' support for solar is? I mean, is it something like mom and apple pie that pretty much everybody supports, in concept at least?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, generally, polls in Arizona and in large part across the country show that solar is popular. When you get down into the nitty-gritty and the details, I think there's still a lot of lack of understanding about what these terms mean. What is energy deregulation? What does that look like? And what effect does it have? You know, what is net metering? I mean, these types of terminologies are not necessarily well understood across society. But I think in general, when you say, do you like solar? Do you support solar? Do you think it's a good part of our energy future? I think people say yes.
Do you think in Arizona that talking about solar, I mean, do the divides break down along traditional party lines? Is it a rural-urban kind of thing? I mean, where is the divergence in opinion?
Well, you know, it's interesting because energy is really a global issue, and we talk about it a lot on the national level. It always is a topic in presidential campaigns. And, you know, certainly it comes up in state legislatures, even gubernatorial races, even local elections. It's interesting to hear what each side is saying in the debates and to see who is on each side. And it really differs. You know, there are a lot of Republicans who believe very firmly in alternative energy, who think that we have to diversify, who think that we have to not rely so much on the Middle East for and their oil interests for our economy to function. And, you know, likewise, there are Democrats who think that we, you know, should build nuclear power plants and should maybe even do things like hydrofracking and other means that are not as sustainable and not as friendly to the environment.
So in your mind, what is the proper role of government in the solar industry?
You know, frankly, I think probably a little bit more in line with some of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle, that if government would get out of the way in terms of picking winners and losers in energy, that the natural progression would be towards alternative sources. The biggest role I think government can and should have in energy is in research and development. What we need to do is be investing in new technologies, new ideas, new innovations of ways to create energy cheaper and cleaner.
That was David Shapira, the former minority leader of the Arizona Senate. Now that the campaigning is over, it's time to start thinking about governing for the two newcomers to the Phoenix City Council, Laura Pastor and Kate Gallego. To find out what kinds of counselors they may be, we turn to Claude Maddox. He served on the City Council from 2000 through last year.
I'm not seeing a huge change, but that being said, I will say that Kate's focus is very, very heavily on economic development and has been. District 4, which is the district that Laura Pastor will be representing, a lot of opportunity there, especially in the central corridor.
The two newcomers are both relatively new to politics. I mean, their families aren't, but right. They themselves are new to elected politics. When you're new to an elected body, how do you, I guess, make your mark, try to set yourself up as so your constituency, okay, this is how this person is going to be in office as opposed to on a campaign trail?
Well, you'll see it quite quickly when you have controversial issues that come to the council. And, it just takes a few votes to see what kind of either leader or what kind of follower a council person is going to be. As far as their own agendas are concerned, it takes a little while to get to a point where you can actually start working your agenda. It'll take at least 6 months to a year, in my opinion, that before they actually will start establishing their agendas and moving forward. They know what they want to do. How do you do it is the question, and that's what they're going to be working on and learning.
It seems like one of the biggest issues this council is going to have to deal with is hiring a new city manager. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the council, as it will be comprised when Gallego and Pastor take their seats on it, will make a similar decision as the council, as it's comprised now, would have made, given the chance?
Well, it's an interesting question because you've got two folks that don't know the players as well as the two council members that are leaving. That being said, it's a very long process, and they will get several opportunities to meet with and talk to all of the candidates, the shortlist candidates anyway. And so by the time it's decision time, they'll know who they feel is going to be the best for the city of Phoenix, and they're going to make that decision predicated on who they feel is going to be the best for the city of Phoenix.
How different do you think the council would have been had either Warren Stewart and or Justin Johnson won?
Again, I wouldn't see a dramatic shift. Warren and Warren Stewart and Michael Johnson, obviously both black, both very, very strong in their convictions to civil rights and the community. I would see some consistency in their governance had Warren been successful. I think that the main difference between Justin and Laura is his business background. I think that there, had it been Stewart and Johnson, there wouldn't be any great huge transition either.
Claude Maddox served on the Phoenix City Council for 12 years. He's now a vice president at the consulting firm Molera Alvarez. For years, politicians have wondered how to get young people engaged with the electoral process. Well, 23-year-old Antonio Valdovinos could help point the way. He was born in Mexico and brought to the United States illegally. Valdovinos and a group of other young people were first spurred to action in 2011 after the Maricopa Community College System, which, by the way, owns KJZZ's license, stopped charging undocumented students in-state tuition.
One of the biggest turning points for me in my life getting involved in politics was when I understood how people got elected. And so once I understood that these elected officials only got elected by a couple hundred ballots, I thought that wasn't good enough, especially when there was a large amount of Latinos that were just not being represented. We got involved and we just simply started knocking on doors and having real compassionate conversations with people at the doors. A lot of people were apathetic back in 2011 about voting. Latinos, they felt like they were going to get ignored either way until we actually came with some material and educating them on like, hey, you want to know why your street hasn't been paved in the last 25 years? Let me tell you why.
Valdovinos helped found the grassroots campaign group known as Team Awesome. That team pounded the pavement to help get Phoenix City Councilman Danny Valenzuela elected. It worked on the unsuccessful 2012 campaigns for Paul Penzone and Rich Carmona. This year, the group was split in its support for candidates in the race for the Phoenix Council's District 8 seat. Some members worked for Lawrence Robinson, who lost in the primary. Valdovinos went to work for Kate Gallego, who was elected Tuesday.
In Kate's campaign, we were able to innovate the way we operated in the field. because you had competing field teams. Also, we went and we targeted Latinos, African-Americans, and everybody in the demographics, but it was mostly people who were interested in these issues. And in the District 8, it was mostly to do with not getting enough of the resources that other council districts were getting.
So what kinds of innovations and new kind of techniques did your campaign come up with to try to target voters?
Well, we'd like to keep that a secret, so, you know, that's how we stayed on top. But, you know, a lot of people tell me, hey, good luck. And it's like, no, we don't need luck. We need persistency and consistency, because we walked since February, and then in June and July, we really pushed it hard. And I call this the war machine, and it's actually a Toyota Prius. You know, we were picking up students from Glendale. We were picking up students from North Phoenix. We were picking up students from South Mountain. We were picking up students all over the place that wanted to be involved in this particular race because they saw a candidate that was so qualified to make a difference in these areas.
You've been successful in a couple of city council races, unsuccessful in a county race and a statewide race. Do you think this kind of campaigning is, in general, more effective in smaller, more concentrated races as opposed to bigger ones with more voters and more geography to cover?
Yes, because you have more control. And when it comes to larger races with the Senate seat, that was half of a state, and there's absolutely no way we could have operated in half a state because we just didn't have any money.
But despite the challenges the group faces, Antonio Valdovino says Team Awesome may reunite for next year's elections, and he says one day he'd like to go to work for the city of Phoenix, putting campaign promises into action. Still to come on the show, in order to develop a human vaccine against deadly spider bites, the spiders themselves must sacrifice for science.
After just 3 or 4 electric shocks, the spiders die. Because of this, and the fact that the amount of venom from each extraction is so tiny, tens of thousands of spiders must be bred to satisfy demand.
An up-close look is still to come. It's the show. If you like what you see outside right now, you're probably going to love the rest of this long weekend. Sunny skies with highs in the mid-80s all the way through Veterans Day on Monday. Look for a high of 87 on Monday. Right now in Phoenix, it's 83 degrees. A couple of traffic problem spots to tell you about, and they're both on I-10 westbound. The exit ramp is blocked at Avondale Boulevard. Same goes for 107th Avenue.
KJZZ is supported by The Persian Room, health-conscious Persian cuisine for lunch and dinner, plus catering for your special occasions and business events. The Persian Room on Scottsdale Road, one light north of Bell, 480-614-1414.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Is AT&T in cahoots with the government on private consumer phone data? You might be excused for answering yes to that after the reports that AT&T is being paid more than $10 million a year to assist the CIA by searching its databases and providing records of calls that may be helpful in identifying terrorism suspects. This cooperation with the CIA is entirely voluntary. According to the reports, AT&T is not acquiescing under subpoenas or court orders in any way. If you go to AT&T's website, they'll click on their privacy policy. It reads, "We will not sell your personal information to anyone for any purpose, period." Okay, so $10 million a year from the CIA, and "we will not sell your personal information, period." There's a discrepancy there, so I called up AT&T customer support. I am a customer. Are you guys selling my data, and can I get a piece of it if you are?
Sir, we're not selling your data.
Yes, you are.
Sir, I have no comment. I cannot give you any information about that because I have not heard of such information. Now, if you have further questions about it, then we would refer you to the government agencies that are doing that, if they're doing that.
The CIA, according to government officials, is paying AT&T more than $10 million a year. Any way I can get a piece of that?
No, sir. No, there's no such program in place that we are aware of, and there's no way for you to make any money off of it.
Well, I don't want to make any money. I just would love to get my bill reduced a little.
Well, then let's see if there's a plan for you that would work better.
Did you get a plan with the CIA to arrange this $10 million a year thing?
Sir, that's not even a fair question. We don't have any knowledge of such a thing.
All right. Well, you know what? Why don't I just check with you maybe a little bit later? You've been very helpful.
All right. Well, I do apologize. I wish I could be more of assistance. No. All right. Well, you have a good day, sir.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Looks like AT&T is not necessarily going to be terribly responsive here. I don't blame them for that. But joining us now to weigh in is Susan Crawford, a professor at Cardozo Law School and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry, a Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Welcome, Susan.
Great to be here.
So is it a fair question or an unfair question for me to try as a consumer to get a piece of that $10 million a year?
Well, let's just expand the question. AT&T says that over 2007-2011, it was actually paid $24 million by the federal government, and then add up all the other telcos you're paying bills to, and then add up the 51 federal agencies that are charging for all kinds of access to consumer records. This is a big issue. I don't think consumers are going to be paid back. I think taxpayers should be worried about how much is going to all this waste.
There's two issues here. One is the government paying for things that seem to violate privacy. That's one sort of legal construct. The other legal construct is, maybe it's commercial. I mean, this data has huge value. If the government's willing to pay that much, how much would other companies, marketing firms, that sort of thing, be willing to pay for it? And what's the legal recourse there? You want to take either one of those?
You know, this is difficult because it's clear that the ability to track a consumer has enormous value for private companies and for the government. And it's unclear that consumers have any way of capturing that value for themselves. It's really a one-way transaction at this point.
What do you think the deal would have been if AT&T executives were in a room with the CIA? All right, for $5 million, we'll give you the Eastern Seaboard. We'll throw in Florida for another $6 million. I mean, I just don't understand how a deal like this is even structured. Is there any sort of legal template here that you understand?
Well, actually, AT&T furnished a schedule of the charges that it incurs for these kinds of wiretaps and other tracking mechanisms. They say they're not even recovering their costs, that it's much more expensive than the $10 million that they charged the FBI to hand over this information. But the larger question is, the whole point is that the CIA is not supposed to be doing domestic surveillance, and AT&T is not supposed to be handing over information unless they have the right legal process in their hands. And we're not clear about either of that.
Is there any precedent in U.S. history of telecom companies, telephone companies, communications companies being in cahoots in an explicit sort of business way with the government on national security matters that precedes the cell phone era?
Ever since the Civil War, the telecommunication companies have been cooperating, not so much making it a profit center. That's new. And the telephone companies' charges here are wildly different. Verizon charges different amounts than AT&T. Sprint, T-Mobile, they're all doing different things. But the cahoot stuff has been going on for a very long time.
Does the government have the right to compel a company to hand over information, whether they pay for it or not?
Well, the statute says the company's not supposed to hand it over unless they get legal process that suffices. But we know that the AT&T has a history of being very casual about how much process it requires. In 2010, AT&T employees actually moved into FBI offices. Uh-huh. And the FBI guys were just giving post-it notes to AT&T and asking for data about customers. They evaded the process almost absolutely. They were just looking over the shoulders of the AT&T employers who were looking into their databases about American subscribers. That abuse was just a couple of years ago, and we don't know if they've cleaned up their act after that.
As a law school professor, do you view this payment by the government to AT&T as essentially a license to get around having to actually get a subpoena to get it for free?
They could all be in cahoots. Everybody does better if they cooperate. AT&T makes some money. The government gets the data that it needs. Everybody feels as if they're helping the country. The problem is there's no accountability. These kinds of abuses led to the Church Committee examinations in the 70s, where we tried to rein in domestic surveillance. We seem to be recapitulating exactly what happened then.
Although the technology today makes it seem as though this is not a cat that can be put back, a horse that can be put back in the barn, whatever you want to say. This doesn't go back in the box.
It looks as if they're going to be vacuuming up data without constraint. The question is whether there's any oversight as to who has access to that data, how it gets used, where it flows. And the charging question is troubling. If companies are actually using this as a profit center, that seems to undermine the entire notion of protecting Americans' privacy.
Until judges are turned into apps that can actually evaluate data on a real-time, moment-to-moment basis, it seems like there's no way to keep up with this in the traditional sort of get a subpoena process.
I'm optimistic that a truly accountable technical system could be set up that would allow us to watch where data is going and be much more efficient about stopping data flows that are inappropriate and abusive. That does seem to be our only hope at this point.
And they probably could work on something like that up at MIT or Harvard in addition to dealing with the law. Susan Crawford is co-director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, professor of law at Cardozo Law School, and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
By the way, we asked AT&T spokesman Mark Siegel about this. He said, in all cases, whenever any governmental entity anywhere seeks information from us, we ensure that the request and our response are completely lawful and proper. We ensure that we maintain customer information in compliance with the laws of the United States and other countries where information may be maintained. Like all telecom providers, we routinely charge governments for producing the information provided. We do not comment on questions concerning national security. Mark Siegel decided he didn't want to go on the air.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. I'm Mark Brody. It's the show. The Phoenix City Council early next year is expected to vote on a new set of standards for street design in the city. The Complete Streets policy aims to make roadways usable for all modes of transportation, not just cars, and for users of all ages and abilities, not just drivers. Phoenix-based urban designer Jeremy Stapleton has been working on this issue with the city for a few years.
It's long been known that Phoenix is really only engineered traffic to serve cars, and it's kind of a, you know, byproduct of the era of transportation planning back about 20 years ago. Since then, we've learned that we can't only serve cars because we have a lot more of the public that's wanting to choose other modes.
Stapleton's met me on Grand near 10th Avenue. He says it's a recently completed and good example of what he'd like to see across Phoenix.
Before this streetscape project got put in, all you really saw here was through lanes. People would come in from Surprise and the northwest suburbs and use Grand Avenue, especially, you know, all Grand Avenue, but this section included, pretty much like a freeway, and you had super high speeds. So the city came in, they reduced the lane of traffic to one way in each direction with a center turn lane. But then they also painted a bright green bike lane, which you can't miss. And in addition, they narrowed the street by providing on-street parking. The intent is to help slow traffic so that not only is it safer, or at least the perception of safety is better from a pedestrian and cyclist, but also slower speeds result in quieter streets. And when you're trying to build attractive residential and retail environments, the sound is almost as important as the visual quality of the street. You know, we're sitting here today and we can still hear the traffic going by, and it's kind of hard to hear each other.
But Stapleton says complete streets aren't just good for the ears, they're also good for the bottom line. Ruben Gonzalez agrees. He owns 11th Monkey on Grand Avenue. He designs and sells T-shirts, as well as lighting fixtures and furniture, among other things. He moved in about 3 months ago, after spending 2 years along Roosevelt Row.
So we moved in like maybe 3 weeks before it got done, and you would see people speeding down this road at like 80 miles an hour. And the minute that these started getting put in, it literally was slowing traffic down. And when you slow traffic down, people tend to look what's around them, you know. And with that happening, this shop has never been busier.
Gonzalez says he's done more business in the last 2 months in his current spot than he did in his last 6 months on Roosevelt. And supporters say narrower roads aren't just good for retailers. Kirby Hoyt is a landscape architect and urban designer with a studio pretty much across the street from Gonzalez's space.
As the business grows and as I hire more people, I want to have them be able to look at this as being an attractive place to work. And so calming down the streets and creating what's been happening, I think, is a catalyst for more retail, more bars and restaurants, those kind of things that are destination opportunities.
Back outside, Jeremy Stapleton says projects like the ones on Grand and First Street downtown should be high on Phoenix's priority list.
transportation-defined cities, especially Phoenix. Right now, our brand is suburbs and traffic, and that brand is no longer in demand. We're watching millennials move to cities that provide them access to the lifestyle that they want. So we're experiencing brain drain. Every week I'm watching new friends leave town again and again. And these are talented people. I see streets as a solution multiplier. They affect the economy. They affect the environment. And they affect our social dynamic.
Stapleton compares Phoenix's streets to desert riverbeds, saying the roadways are engineered to have flash floods twice a day, preventing anything from taking hold. But he says it doesn't have to be this way. Stapleton wants different communities within the city to design streets that work for them.
We're getting the people that want to live a suburban lifestyle, but we're not getting the people that want to live an urban lifestyle. So if we really want to compete, if we really want to attract high-wage employers, then we got to start providing them access to that lifestyle.
Assuming the city council goes ahead and says, okay, we support this, what does that mean? What happens in the city?
The policy is going to require that every street project goes through the lens of complete streets. And the staff's gonna have to look for opportunities to provide better infrastructure for biking, walking, and transit, instead of just kind of ignoring those modes and just paving the way for more cars. So that alone is going to be a major shift.
Ann Stapleton says he's confident the council will adopt complete streets. If it does, he says Phoenix will join the more than 250 other communities across the country that have already done so. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Amanda Gabbert, and I am having a family barbecue at the park. Just to get together, family time. I am here with my mom, my extended family, my best friend. There's a nice breeze, lots of green grass, sand to play, and a nice jungle gym. It's open area, we can play soccer or play football.
That's Amanda Gabbert with her family and friends picnicking at Mountain View Park. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. We'd like to hear from you. The show at KJZZ.org. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ at 2:38. I'm Mark Brody. The show is one of KJZZ's original productions, bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. And still to come, we'll explore an oasis of calm smack in the middle of the city's hubbub.
If I lifted that grate right there in that grass, you would hear all of the heavy traffic sounds. I-10, it's right here.
We unveil the location in just a few minutes. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein.
Recent U.S. economic history has taught us that business bounces back to energetic levels and unemployment levels sink within about 2 years of a recession ending. If it seems like individuals are still waiting for that bounce, that inspiration at the end of a rough stretch, well, so are nonprofits. Connie Phillips, Executive Vice President of the Alliance of Arizona Nonprofits, says government and corporate support continue to drop.
Statistically out there, people reporting that overall individual giving is actually increasing. The thing to be aware of, though, with nonprofit giving is that individual giving is a large part of the charitable giving. It's almost 80%. And in fact, according to ASU, this last year in Arizona, it was 90% of all charitable giving. But it's actually not the largest way that nonprofits are supported, that nonprofits receive a large amount of their funding from governments, from contracts, from fees for service. And so if you just look at the sector overall, those places we're still experiencing decreases, especially with the government funding and contracting, is those are decreasing between sequestration and cuts in block grants, all of the things that are happening. So even though maybe individual giving may be slightly increasing, 3.5%, you're getting on the other end these decreases that are continuing to squeeze the nonprofit. And for this next year, as far as the projections mm-hmm. go, it appears that most nonprofits are predicting that they will actually have less money to be able to do services than they did the previous year. And they're expecting the demand to increase. And for the first time since they've been doing these surveys, nonprofits are saying, we're not sure we can meet the demand this time.
So is the reality that things just have not bounced back enough?
Nonprofits have gone through their reserves. You know, 3 years ago, nonprofits it's always been a struggle, but generally had some wiggle room. They had some reserves set aside. Well, now we've gone through that. We've squeezed it as tightly as we can. The government money is not coming back. Corporations are not coming back, especially with the arts, are not coming back with bigger funding. People are still nervous about buying tickets. You know, so it's still very sketchy for nonprofits. And people kind of underestimate the amount of public-private partnership there is with government contracting. And, you know, these things that are happening at the larger level, the threat of those continued cuts, and then on top of that, the conversation that's happening around tax reform and the threat that we could lose the charitable giving deduction, you know, all those things are really keeping nonprofits very nervous about what may happen in the next year or so.
Are there other factors, Connie, that affect individual giving? Does it always have to do with how much money someone has in their pocket?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the largest portion of nonprofit giving, just if you look at like who gives the most out of not in dollar amounts, but, you know, in comparison to their income, is actually that lower and middle income groups. Partly is because they see the need. It's close to them. They know why help is important. So the most generous part of our society are actually those who make lower incomes than those with large incomes. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start talking about the large income folks, you know, things like tax incentives and how their portfolio is doing and all those things are all, you know, factors for them in their giving. I guess one of the good news is we're still in the bullish market for the stock market, so hopefully people are feeling better, but people are nervous. They just aren't confident that this is going to continue. Previously, I was executive director at Sojourner Center, and we had a lot of people who made long-term pledges to us. Mm-hmm. Well, that became more difficult as the recession was, you know, going into its depths, because people were like, I'll make a contribution, but I can't do a pledge. And those are the things that make it difficult for nonprofits to plan.
Connie Phillips says nonprofits are planning on April 9th of next year. That's when Arizona Gives will take place, when individual donations to a long list of nonprofits in the state will be matched.
The children of migrant farm workers sometimes face a life on the move, meaning their education is continually interrupted. The federal government helps them catch up and keep up through the Migrant Education Program. From San Diego, Jill Replogle looks at how the program works today in one of Southern California's major agricultural areas.
Several hundred teenagers filed into a swanky event center in the Imperial Valley town of Heber on a recent Friday morning. These high schoolers, nearly all of them Latino, are here for a college prep seminar. Some of their parents have probably worked in the hay fields that surround the place. The message for these kids: go to college.
My parents came here like your parents. They came here with a dream.
Jaime Carias is a recruiter for the College Assistance Migrant Program, or CAMP, a federally funded program that gives students from migrant families intensive support to help them get through their first year of college. Carias knows how hard that is.
First in my family to graduate from high school.
He's also the first in his family to get a college degree and the first to have a career, not just a job. Many students here will boast such firsts, and some of them will thank the Federal Migrant Education Program for helping them succeed. Edward R. Murrow's 1960 documentary, Harvest of Shame, shed light on the dismal lives of American farm workers and the educational hurdles faced by their children.
She really likes to go to school, but she had to miss last week because she had to keep the baby for me to work.
The documentary helped spur the passage of federal legislation to improve opportunities for migrant students. Today, the Migrant Education Program serves about 345,000 students aged 3 to 21 across the country. California has by far the biggest program, serving some 80,000 migrant students. That includes tutoring and help making up coursework and credits they might miss because their families move around during the school year. That's the case for Annalise Sine, a junior at Holtville High School.
You start the year and they teach you something, and then when you move, they teach you something completely different.
Up until recently, she would start each school year in Hollister, some 8 hours north, and end it in the Imperial Valley. Sine's mother is a farm worker, but Annalise's path is shaping up to be a much different one.
I was planning on going to UC Santa Cruz and becoming a marine biologist.
And you think you'll get there?
Yes, I think I will get there because, I don't know, I'm really determined, and like whenever I want something, I usually get it.
Diego Lopez says migrant parents seem to increasingly prioritize education for their children. Lopez is the principal of Frank Wright Middle School in Imperial.
In the past, for economic reasons, the families would take the kids with them. And in many cases, they were also part of the labor force.
Now, he says, parents are more likely to make arrangements so that their kids can stay in the same school throughout the year while parents follow the crops.
And so a lot of these kids stay with relatives, an aunt, a grandma, a neighbor. That in itself is a hardship.
Academically, at least, those tough decisions may be paying off. According to data from the California Department of Education, migrant students in the Imperial Valley graduate at slightly higher rates than the student population as a whole, and fewer of them drop out of school. Statewide, on the other hand, migrant students still graduate at a lower rate than the general population. All of this data, however, isn't entirely reliable, according to the state's official watchdog. In a recent report, the California State Auditor's Office criticized the State Department of Education for failing to evaluate the effectiveness of its migrant program. A spokesman for the Education Department said an evaluation was being finalized.
Good morning again. We're going to begin.
Back at the college prep seminar in Heber, many migrant students said they were grateful for the extra boost they were getting from the migrant education program. Julie Mosqueda is a senior at Central Union High School in El Centro.
Oh, it has been awesome because they call you in, they look over your grades, tell you, like, okay, you can fix this, go to tutoring. And that helped me a lot with my college applications because they have my transcript already. They're ready for me to go in and apply.
Mosqueda says she's applying to 3 state universities and wants to study kinesiology. Her parents?
I don't even think they made it to high school.
Mosqueda says her parents motivate her to seek out and face her challenges in the classroom. In the Imperial Valley, I'm Jill Replogle.
Couple problem spots on Valley freeways, although I-10 westbound looking a lot better than it did just about 20 minutes or so ago. The only problem left right now, the accident on I-10 westbound at Avondale is now blocking the shoulder. Also, 101 southbound in the East Valley, an accident blocking the shoulder at Broadway. It'll be sunny across the valley throughout this holiday weekend. Look for highs each day right around 85 with clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-50s. It's 83 degrees under sunny skies right now.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing Steak Lovers, with a selection of steaks, kebabs, and burgers ground fresh daily. A list of 11 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. The show, one of KJZZ's original programs. Brazil is home to thousands of species of spider, many of which are poisonous and can give deadly bites. Antivenom can save people, but making that antivenom is time-consuming and expensive. Not only that, the production process kills thousands of spiders and slowly poisons the horses used to make the necessary antibodies. Now scientists in Brazil have developed a new synthetic spider venom, which promises to make battling spider bites a whole lot simpler and could even lead to a human vaccine, as the BBC's fearless Ben Tavener discovered.
The southern city of Curitiba has the unenviable title of being Brazil's brown spider capital. And it's here that I've come to meet school assistant Adelaide Fabianski Maia, who nearly died after being bitten.
It was 9 a.m. and I felt a bite on my leg, but I didn't know what it was. It could have been any insect, really. Then at 5 p.m., the top of my leg went red and started swelling up, and my face started burning. Later, I looked and there was a red circle, which later went yellow and then black. That's when I was rushed to hospital.
Although the bites are rarely painful, brown spider venom slowly infiltrates the skin and kills it, causing excruciating lesions. In some cases, the bites can kill through multiple organ failure. The only way to stop it is by using an antivenom, which are made using real spider venom. I've come to the pioneering Butantan Institute in São Paulo to see how the venom is extracted. A technician gingerly fishes out a spider and gives it an electric shock to make it surrender its venom. A second technician rushes in to suck the drops of venom up into a syringe.
This is a different species of brown spider. This
use more serum than the other species.
However, other animals are also used in antivenom production, as biologist Dr. Samuel Ghisi explains.
Here we milk the spiders, then this venom goes to the production sector and injected in the horses. After 40 days, horses are bled and the antibodies are separated from the blood.
These antibodies, which are triggered as an immune response when the spider venom enters the horse, are the key ingredient in the antivenom. However, the process is costly, both financially and in terms of the animals' lives. A pile of twitching and lifeless arachnids next to the extraction technicians represents the grisly truth about spider milking. After just 3 or 4 electric shocks, the spiders die. Because of this, and the fact that the amount of venom from each extraction is so tiny, tens of thousands of spiders must be bred to satisfy demand. The horses in the process are also slowly poisoned, meaning that instead of living around 20 years, the horses involved typically die after just 3 or 4. Current antivenoms are also not perfect for humans. There's no doubt that work here at the Butantan Institute has saved thousands of human lives and many more from the devastating effects of spider bites. But I'm going to meet scientists who say they've developed an alternative, a new synthetic spider venom, which they say produces a safer serum for humans and a better deal for animals.
Una vez identificado entonces
Dr. Carlos Chavez Olortegui invites me to his lab in the Federal University of Minas Gerais to tell me about the breakthrough.
We identified the parts of the protein responsible for creating antibodies and made a protein chain containing only these segments and checked they were non-toxic but still capable of triggering the antibodies that neutralize the effects of the venom.
This should mean that a non-toxic venom can be injected into horses, which doesn't poison them, meaning the horses could in theory be retired after a few years' work. However, the team wants all animals to be written out of the equation eventually. But there's a second strand to this new protein chain, the tantalizing possibility of a vaccine in humans, meaning people could be immunized against spider bites. Dr. Chavez Olortegui again.
We carried out a preliminary test on rabbits and horses, and the results showed the right antivenom antibodies being made with no negative effects to the animals. More tests are required to see if the level of immunization is maintained long term, but we believe we are on the right path and indeed close to being able to make a human vaccine soon. Nós acreditamos que estamos em caminho certo e estamos muito perto de chegar a vacina para uso humano.
A future debate weighing the cost of developing such a vaccine against the chance of actually being bitten is inevitable. But as 26,000 spider bites were reported in Brazil in 2012 alone, scientists here believe there will be interest in the vaccine, particularly in high-risk areas.
That's the BBC's Ben Taverner. A statue is being unveiled to remember the creator of the Family Circus comic strip literally as we speak. Bill Keane's family is erecting his memorial exactly 2 years after his death. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
The statue is a 9-foot bronze model of Bill Keane carrying the family circus characters. Bill's youngest son, Jeff, says he modeled the statue on a porcelain figurine his father created back in the 80s.
That was a great inspiration. We thought, oh, that's it. We could do, we'll have our dad with his characters on his back.
The memorial is in Scottsdale at McCormick Stillman Railroad Park, sandwiched between the carousel and the railroad track. Jeff says it was important for his family to have the memorial at a kid-friendly place.
What's great about this park is that it's full of families, a lot of kids running around, a lot of noise, a lot of irritation, which is just like every other family, and that's what the Family Circus was about.
Bill began the comic in 1960, and it has appeared in 1,500 newspapers since. KJZZ did an interview with Bill to commemorate the 44th anniversary of his comic in 2004. In that interview, he said so many Americans are able to connect with his comic because of the relatable family dynamic.
I think the family structure has changed. You have your single moms, you have your working mothers and dads of all kinds. Every type of home has its own structure, but I feel that the family itself is the backbone of America.
Bill's son, Jeff, fell into the family business when he started helping his father ink the comic after college. Jeff says taking over has helped him stay connected to his dad.
When I sit down and I look at, you know, a blank sheet of paper or whatever, you know, I'm drawing, you know, I'm drawing my dad, and I'm drawing my mom, and I'm drawing, you know, my brothers and sisters. Every day, I remember my dad.
Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Scottsdale.
In the middle of a busy downtown Phoenix is a quiet place with pear trees, koi ponds, and waterfalls. Sounds unlikely, but it's true. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us about this oasis at Margaret T. Hance Park.
Since 1976, Himeji Japan and Phoenix have been connected by the Sister City program. Himeji is a small town on the western edge of the country. Did you know Himeji helped create the Japanese Friendship Garden, where Phoenicians now go to meditate?
It's supposed to be a microcosm of all of the different elevations that you find in Japan.
Deborah Barnes is a docent at the Roho-en. That's the name of the garden. Ro is for the Japanese bird heron. Ho is the phoenix bird, and N means garden.
The grasslands area is reminiscent of many of the grasslands that you find in Japan.
I'm visiting early in the morning when no one's around, since talking is to be kept at a minimum. We try to chat as quietly as possible. The 3.5-acre garden is nearly silent. You can barely hear the freeway below.
If I lifted that grate right there in that grass, you would hear the sounds, all of the heavy traffic sounds underneath on the way east toward Tucson, I-10. It's right here.
This place was just a strolling garden when first built in 1993. All it had at the time was a tea house, where traditional tea ceremonies are still held once a month, and the bamboo plants around it. In 20 years, it's grown a lot. There's a pond where 300 koi fish swim. Barnes says the tranquil waterfalls and concrete bridge are designed by Himeji architects.
In Japanese folklore, evil spirits can only travel in straight lines, so we try not to give them any straight lines. Thus, the crooked bridge. And that ends up being the favorite place of everyone to toss koi food to the koi.
The garden is also adorned with stone-carved lanterns and sculptures representative of the Japanese culture. They're strategically located throughout the garden as points for meditation. At one end of the pond, a cobblestone beach leads right up into the main waterfall.
These stones, they are so similarly gray-toned that they don't seem busy and they don't distract your eye from the rest of the view. It's amazing that this tranquility that you hear, this quiet, is right on top of the Deck Park Tunnel.
So this contribution by the city of Himeji, it hasn't been reciprocated. Barnes says Phoenix is yet to present its sister city with its own token of friendship, and there are no plans for a gift anytime soon. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
Did you know that we want to hear from you? I bet you did. Send us your notes, theshow@kjzz.org. Well, coming up on 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, that means time to start thinking about what you're going to do this weekend. It is a long holiday weekend for a lot of folks. There are a couple of Veterans Day events, at least a couple of Veterans Day events. In Mesa, the East Valley Veterans Parade is tomorrow, starts at 11 o'clock at 8th and Center Streets in Mesa. On Monday, the Phoenix Veterans Day Parade starts at 11 o'clock at North Phoenix Baptist Church. That's at Central and Bethany Home. Then heads south and east, south, and goes a little bit further down to Indian School Road. Elsewhere, a lot of sports going on this weekend as well. The Suns take on the Nuggets tonight. The Cardinals host the Houston Texans on Sunday afternoon. ASU opens its men's basketball season tonight against University of Maryland, Baltimore County. You can also check out at Westworld of Scottsdale tomorrow the Vintage Market. More than 100 vendor booths with handmade or vintage crafts, photo opportunities, and giveaways. This is the show. It's coming up on 301 on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.
KJZZ is supported by Canal Convergence, engaging and inspiring all ages through art as UK artists Aether and Hamera launch Voyage, a mobile interactive installation, November 7th to 10th on the Scottsdale waterfront.